This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers produce over 600 varieties, types, and styles of cheese. That's twice as much as any other state. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we celebrate good news in the food world, from record-setting butter sculptures to the latest discoveries in crop cultivation.
I think it was back in 2015. It was 2,370 pounds, and it was a Paris landscape. And so that became the Guinness World Record butter sculpture.
We don't understand everything about the world. So plant breeding also lets us work with all the unknown, maybe discovered along the way.
And we hear from the beloved chef and disaster relief organizer, Jose Andres.
Well, World Central Kitchen, we're an organization that we like to be the first ones on the ground. And more often than not, we are the last ones on the ground.
Tune in to Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
I'm Greg Benson.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
You look a little tired. I am. I'm riding on adrenaline in a dream right now. I was on a megabus about 90 minutes ago, working on, you know, a good like 120 minutes of sleep for the night. I was down in D.C. I was actually supposed to get back in last night, but the Washington Nationals, a.k.a. America's team, a.k.a. The baseball team from Washington, D.C., had a chance to and eventually did clinch a spot to go to the World Series last night. So I was like, I can't.
But they go all the time, right?
Oh, no. They have not been since 1933. So this is and I realized this last night. I was like, I'm going to bring this up on the show today. So this will be the third time the World Series has been in D.C., but it will be the first time that Washingtonians will be able to drink beer during the World Series, because the other three times were all during Prohibition.
What?
Yeah.
That's a fascinating little tidbit.
That is how long it's been.
I can't imagine. You know, it's things you don't even think about. Like, I would have assumed sports just went on hiatus during Prohibition, because who wants to sit in the stadium and not
exactly.
have a beer?
I know. It seems boring. Like,
well, baseball's pretty boring to me in the first place, but
you're not drinking enough beer, dude.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a fascinating little piece to the puzzle. You didn't mention that off the air. That's cool.
Yeah.
But so you were going to come home last night, but you decided to stay and party. Well, you were forced to, right?
Because exactly. I know. I didn't want to.
Your team.
I had to.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a must. And you were there at the stadium.
I was there. I was watching at a bar across the street from the stadium.
Wait. You traveled all the way there to not go to the stadium?
I mean, I didn't have $400 lying around. I also went the night before. So, you know, I didn't have a spare $400 lying around to go in. But I was watching across the street. And it was funny because the broadcasts are on like a 15-second delay, I guess, if the players accidentally swear, you know.
Of course, yeah.
If they do the thing that we're allowed to do all the fucking time on the air, you can't have that on TBS.
Right.
So we're watching it on the TVs, and like behind us, we can hear the crowd. So like you'll be watching, and you hear like, ah, and you're like, oh, something good's about to happen. You hear, ooh, and you're like, oh, this is going to be bad. So last out of the game, they're showing all the photos of, like, you know, the stands of, like, all the fans looking tense and, like, watching through their fingertips. We're watching this on TV. Behind us, fireworks are going off, and, like, we can hear people screaming. So you're kind of looking back and forth, like, I got a good feeling about where this is going. I think this is going to work out for him in the end. Yeah, 15 seconds later, they did it, man. World Series in D.C. How about that?
Outstanding. Since 1933. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's about time they had a good season.
It's been a minute.
I know so little about baseball. Well, my week has been pretty good. Did some pretty cool stuff at the new Amari Amargo. Had a tasting with Fred Jerbis, Amari, and Seren over there last night, which was tons of fun. About 40 people showed up and drank some unique new Amari that are new to the market. And also, just a side note, amid all the other things I've been doing, I finished a book.
Yeah. This guy told us about this 5 minutes ago in the studio.
I forgot, yeah.
Didn't even mention. It was like, oh, yeah, and by the way, he's like, what did I do this week? And
that, sort of forgot, yeah. Turned in the manuscript. It's good. It's called, I wrote a holiday book, right? So it's going to be, for the first time ever, my publishing company is doing what's called POD, print on demand. So when you order this book, they'll print one and send it to you. It's not like there are going to be stacks of them sitting around. It's got a lot of graphics, but no photos. And it's a holiday book, and we called. I decided to call it "Let's Get Blitzen," and nice. You know the tagline is "Happy Alcohol Holidays." So they're all like Christmas themed drinks, drinks you can make in advance, punch bowls, etc. And hopefully we'll have it up online by the end of the week, actually. So
congratulations,
and we'll have it available all the way through the holidays.
This
holiday
is like
season.
Your hip hop holiday,
yeah, exactly.
Album that you're Starbucks yeah, right. Christmas album.
Yeah, so I think next I'll do like an Easter one and maybe a Halloween. I don't
you
know.
Got to collab with Arbor Day. Martha Stewart at some point.
Who knows?
Follow the we'll Snoop Dogg method.
We'll get there. You know? Well, listen, I don't know anything, and admittedly, I don't know anything about sports, but our guest today knows plenty about at least one sport. We got Justin Noel in here from Sweetwater Social. You're also the trade advocacy manager. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Close enough?
Close enough.
For London Essence, which is a line of sodas. You're also a brand rep for all kinds of brands. You're a world traveler. You never sit still, which I think is why you and I click so well. We're both busy all the time. But you were a former professional football player?
Yeah.
Soccer. Football meaning yeah, soccer yeah. in this case, yeah.
I was going to say, I think a lot of people who
football,
know me.
Football. You got to like put that weird.
What position did Justin play in football? The kicker? Could have been.
But that's a little while ago. How long ago was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's almost a a lifetime ago. I'm 38 now, and I retired at 21. So
what? Living yeah. off the 401k ever since, huh?
I have my own 401k now. But yeah, no, it's a while ago. I've let my body really kind of absorb that retirement quite nicely.
Who did you play for? Where were you?
Well, I played for a couple teams. I played in England for a team called Blackpool. Played in France for a team called Bordeaux. Played in Italy for a team called Empoli, and then finished up my career playing in the Netherlands for a team called Haarlem, which is right outside of Amsterdam. So,
Outstanding. You know, I mean, I think usually the first segment of the show is us talking about kind of who's in the room and what they've done in the past, right? That then we build up to who the hell are you, and then in the second half we talk about like what you do now.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always fascinated about the things that I hear from different people, you know. And I think you're the first. These were professional teams you played for, right?
Yeah.
You're the first professional athlete I think we've had on the show.
Well, I don't know if there's a ranking,
a tote system. Board. Yeah, we'll make that. One. We'll make one. You're now
right
at
the bar. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great thing about like this industry is, and the bartender industry, I should say, is that you know really everybody has a very unique story as to how and why they're in this industry. And almost, except for I think maybe some bartenders that exist nowadays, you know, who've just come into the occupation. I think everybody started off doing something else before they decided, you know what, I'm going to get behind this bar and serve some drinks. And mine just happened to have been sports related, and very happy to have that opportunity. It's not a very, you know, it's not an opportunity that most people get to have, but it definitely, I think, impacted me in a way that provided me really good like context in terms of work ethic going forward once I moved into the bar industry itself. So
I think the people who succeed the best in bar and hospitality are people who have some other chunk of their past that led them to what you just said, like a better work ethic, a better, you know, the ability to just speak to people. I mean, if you lived in all those different places, you spoke to a lot of different peoples.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you're like, you know, automatically sort of trained to then speak to whoever walks through the door, right?
Right. And then the cool thing was, is that being overseas playing, you know, obviously you grow up quite quickly. You embrace cultures quickly. You learn about cultures. You kind of have to if you want to survive in these places. If not, you're stranded and you don't eat and you just kind of like wander around. And this is pre cell phone, pre smartphone days where if I wanted to talk to my parents, I had to buy like the international calling card.
Oh, the phone
to go
card,
to.
Yeah.
So sure. I wasn't being able to like, hey Siri, point me in the direction of a place where I can get some food. so there's that. But then also, you know, they have different laws regarding alcohol. So you also embrace alcohol at a younger age, but I was also able to start bartending during the off season to kind of really make some extra money and stay in the cities to train. And you know, really, you start to learn how drinking cultures in those countries evolved and what they hold true and how they drink. And I will say it also helps you with the language a lot better as well, because there's no better place than being behind a bar. When somebody comes up and orders something in Italian or Dutch, and you have to figure that out really quickly. And
right, because so there's a transaction to be made here.
Yeah,
it's not just like, I can't understand this guy.
So, I mean, I remember like, you know, and obviously Dutch is not a language that's super universal. And I remember like my first day bartending in Holland at a nightclub, you know, some guy, loud nightclub, you know, very noisy. A friend of a friend had got me the job. And, was definitely one of those things where I'm like behind the bar and I'm just like ready for my shift, and like first customers come to the bar and this guy walks up and he orders like fear, like literally the, you know, my Dutch is awful, by the way, so anybody who's listening and hears what I'm about to say is probably gonna call in or write you guys an email like, that's awful. But it goes fear beer chase, and I just remember being like, what? And he ordered again, and I literally turned to the guy next to me and I was like, hey, you speak Dutch, right? And
are we gonna have to do this all night long?
And
he was like yes, I'm Dutch, I do speak
exactly.
Dutch.
And I was like, so he's saying fear beer chase, and the guy goes, oh yeah, it means four beers. And I was like, okay, this is gonna be a long night.
Well,
so but now you know the beer word chase for four
and
the
four
word for beer. Yeah.
So I imagine that a lot of it, you know, it's loud, so luckily there's probably like a lot of pointing.
100%.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
pointing and
this?
And three fingers up and those. Okay, yeah,
which
three
was different
those,
than my time in London when bartending, which was, you know, back then it was like, just make it pink and sweet and you're good. So it doesn't matter what they order. Throw some tins around, make it pink and sweet. Doesn't matter what they order, and you just give them, they're happy. So it was, you know, part of the evolution of bartending was going from pink to swing to a peak. Pink and sweet to four beers in Dutch, you know?
So. Yeah. So where are you from that led you to be a professional soccer player all over the world? You don't sound like you're from any of the places you listed.
Definitely not, no. So I am from the U.S. I know it's a crazy thing. Soccer players come from the U.S. I was born and raised in New York and Georgia. I was very lucky. Georgia, the state, not the country. My parents...
I was born in Atlanta. Where are you from in Georgia?
Athens.
Oh, yeah.
So I was born here and then moved to Georgia when I was 12. And my dad had a law firm in Georgia. So we relocated down there. And, spent a good chunk of time in the South. And my dad played soccer. My mom's family is Italian. So soccer was a big part of my brother and I's life. And I guess just the one sport that we really gravitated towards because you can play it in relatively confined spaces as well as in big open spaces.
Yeah, it doesn't require a lot of equipment.
Yeah, so, like, you know, when you're growing up and you're a kid,
you got a ball, you're good.
Yeah, and you're growing up as a kid, like, and you got a brother who's, like, relatively close to you in age, you can just, you know, you're going to kick something. You're either going to kick them or you're going to kick a ball. So we decided to kick a ball together, and we were able to play it in Astoria, and then we... Very happy that our parents were big fans of the sport because my dad had me and my brother playing at the ages of like four in competitive, like, you know, under four, under five. You know, I wouldn't say it's competitive leagues, but, you know, had us playing. And then, just very lucky to, I guess, be blessed with some natural talents that when we made the opportunities provided to us to, you know, either join X and Y teams that would have allowed us to get to the next level. We took advantage of them, and we were able to showcase our skills in certain tournaments, which gave us exposure.
Were you like playing for high school or?
No. So, I mean, club football is a big thing. So in the U.S., like, you know, because we don't really have a lot of professional teams, especially at this time, we had none that were of any good or any quality. You didn't have like youth teams. So usually in this country, youth programs and traveling teams are kind of the way that you get exposed to soccer in this country. You know, it's kind of a pay to play situation in this country, which is different than most countries. So you sign up to be part of an organization, you try out, you get on the team, and then your parents get a bill for like X amount of dollars regarding like your uniform, your travel fees, the organizational fees and all that stuff. And, you know, if you're really good, you get to pay more money because then you get opportunities to play for better teams, which they can charge you more and more dollars. So it's a very backward system in this country, because obviously in most countries that has soccer and football, that's usually a poor person sport. Most of the talent comes from the poor financial brackets of their cultures. But there, if you're really good, teams,
they want you.
Yeah, they sign you, and then they provide you with your living and your food and your uniforms and your training for no cost.
Because they want a good player, right?
Yeah, they invest in you, and they hope that you're going to come good for them, or if not, they sell you for money, and they're very happy. So, but yeah, in this country, it's a little bit different. And
again, anyway, you made it. You went through all those trials and tribulations. You made it. You
did a lot of running.
And then you got to a lot of running. That's what that sport is, just kind of chasing a ball. And then you went off to all these European countries as a young man, but when you get there, drinking is available at a younger age, right?
100%. As soon as I got off the plane at 16, your first thing is you're going out to the pub with the team.
Yeah.
What was 16. That like? Like, that's... you just go insane? Like, or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, well, I also... Let me qualify this in the sense that, like, or I should say quantify this, in that my parents being of Italian culture, I started being exposed to alcohol probably at, like, 10 or 11 anyways.
Right.
Granted, they weren't, like, you know, pouring me full glasses of wine and or saying, hey, Justin, you want to, you know,
but it's an introduction. I feel like, you know, frankly, there's a lot of things we do in this country that I think are backwards and wrong, just like you listed with the whole soccer situation. That seems backwards and wrong. And I think also we have a backwards approach to alcohol. We don't. We should expose, you know, our children to it at an earlier age so that they don't have this, you know, this freak out.
Demystify.
I'm going to go crazy when I turn 21 right. because, you know, or, you know, maybe 18 because I'm hiding it or whatever. But, like, when I'm 21, it's on, right? We're going out and getting just shit canned.
Oh, yeah.
100%. We're going to be thrown up in the bathroom and, you know, just 21 shots in 21 hours or whatever the fucking thing is.
All you have to do is go to an American university during what they call, like, the first school. 2 weeks of school, like pledge rushing and
return,
and you will be exposed to the most unhealthy ways of not only just drinking, but how unhealthy it is to have 18 and 17 year olds who've never been away from their families and never been away from their parents all of a sudden thrust into positions where they have no oversight, no authority, and people are literally demanding that they consume as much alcohol as possible in order to get into an organization. Of which you, again, going to have to pay to be part of.
Right, yeah. Whereas when in European countries, you know, when kids hit the legal age, they're just like, yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah,
like,
I mean.
I'm already exposed to this.
It's fine. Would say I didn't really, like, come out, like, you know, when I had the opportunity at 16 to start drinking, you know, I think 16-year-old does, or any teenager does, when given the first opportunity to do something where their parents aren't around and there's really no, like, you know, parental authority around, you tend to kind of overindulge.
Yeah, you're looking for the limits. Yeah. Let's push them.
And I definitely overindulge when I, you know, the first year easily of being abroad, not having any real oversight, you know, drinking was part of the football culture, especially in England at the time. So, you know, I definitely saw that as a way to bond with my teammates, but bond with the senior players. And, it definitely impacted me in a way that probably was both good and bad. But, you know, yeah, you kind of start at an early age, and I think it's better to make mistakes at 16 than it is making mistakes at 18, 19, 20, 21.
Oh, yeah, because you can be tried as a minor.
100%.
Yeah.
But I also think you can retain the lessons at a younger age, and you go, all right, you know, as I get older, I've now know I can get away with this. I can't get away with this. And, you know,
well, I feel like if when I'm younger, I can learn, oh, that singed me. I'm not going to touch that much. Whereas when I'm older, I got to get burned.
Yeah. and 16, when you come from the U.S., when, like, at the time, if you remember, like, we really didn't have high gravity beer in this country until, like, the mid to, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And so even that adapting to the strength of the beer compared to, like, Budweiser over here or Bud Light, you know, was a learning curve because they drink heavy, especially at this time in the mid-90s, like, you know, 96, 97, 98 is when I moved over. They're drinking, like, stouts. They're drinking porters. They're drinking heavy, like, brown ales that are, like, you know, 8, 9, 10%. And you're, like, trying to keep up with
drinking
these.
Soup.
Yeah, and you're trying to keep up with these guys because, you know, not only am I American, so I have to stand up for the entire country of America.
Sure.
But
you're the representative.
Yeah, the wrong representative at the time, I definitely can tell you that much. But, you know, you're representing your country, and you're also, you're trying to, you know, as any, I think, adolescent does, try to show that they can hold their own with an adult. And, you know, you have some dark nights or some nights where you're spending on the bathroom floor.
Some really rough mornings and then having to go out and run around all day and chase a ball.
That was always fun.
Well, at least you sweat it out. Yeah. All right. Listen, let's take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about more bar stuff with Justin Noel. Stay tuned.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe, taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Tickets available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
And we're back on the Speakeasy, hanging out with Justin Noel in the studio today. Yeah, that gala is going to be great.
I'm so excited, man.
On the 11th, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been for the last 3 years in a row. Sadly, this year I cannot go, but you're going to go in my stead and make drinks, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When's 100%. The gala?
November 11th.
Oh, yeah. It's Portland Cocktail Week.
That's where I'll be.
I will be there as well.
Yeah.
I'll be here schmoozing and boozing.
Yeah.
Nice. What I've been training my whole life for. Speaking of training, by the way, we were talking about this a little bit during the break, but you as an athlete, you know, obviously are familiar with, you know, a certain level of, you know, training your body, training your mind, living kind of like a, maybe not the most balanced lifestyle as a 16-year-old, but certainly kind of like trying to find that, like, how do I get the most out of this, you know, out of my body while also kind of like, you know, keeping my mind sharp and clearly having some fun,
right?
Which is something that our industry has kind of come around to recently, like in the last 2 or 3 years, and frankly it's overdue. There's been a big shift towards, like, you know, staying healthy, like make sure you stretch before your shift, mm-hmm. like how to, you know, maintain a healthy lifestyle in this industry that can be pretty punishing physically. Like, I don't know, so you've kind of are maybe a little bit ahead of the curve, maybe not, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely could tell you when I first moved back to New York in 2008, I kind of, and I was talking about this off air with you guys, I definitely probably didn't take advantage of my skill set in a way to kind of maybe provide for my staffs or kind of lead them by example. Definitely was more about, I think at the time, really kind of just trying to get our occupation to a level of credibility that I wanted, you know, us to all profit from, so that people looked at us as like, you know, you're on the same level as people in IT, and, you know, this is a real occupation and it's not some just in between thing. Where, you know, now that I think we've kind of set the foundation for that, for this to be a real, you know, occupation where you can do this for, you know, your entire life if you want to. I think now we're seeing, all right, well, we need to also then, if we want to do this successfully long term, we have to start thinking about how this impacts our body, right?
Yeah.
And I wish I had been better at leading that in the beginning, because I also have some amazing partners in throughout my career. Tim Cooper, who I own Sweetwater with, big into boxing, played basketball. Willie Shine, who was part of who owned Contemporary Cocktails, I used to work with, also athlete. So I was always surrounded
by surfer.
Yeah, big surfer.
I'm always watching his Instagram. He's always on the beach.
Yeah, and you know, and we kind of always surrounded ourselves with athlete bartenders, and we as ourselves, as our little, you know, close knit group, we would do activities together and be athletic. But I don't think we kind of realized, you know, how to take that and then provide a platform to younger bartenders, or to turn it into something that would help bartenders in our community. I think it was just something that innately we did because we liked playing around and doing sport together. But then, as to your point, like, I don't know if we were ahead of the curve. We just honestly were just athletes who bartended and enjoyed doing athletic endeavors. But now, to your point, yeah, it's definitely something that I've seen. And I've been happy to see even more so now with, like, what has transpired with the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation.
For sure.
Yeah. They're really kind of championing these initiatives and really kind of bringing in some people who live in the space and work in the space who are from our industry, and really giving them the platform to promote these ideas. I mean, I remember, I don't even know if you remember this, Alex, but like, I remember Alex Day doing a seminar I want to say like maybe 5-6 years ago about like shaking and how like shaking with the cold draft ice that we were using and the big block ice at the time.
It was very jarring.
It was jarring and yeah. It was giving us tennis elbow. And I think he brought in a yoga instructor or somebody to help kind of like showcase why you need to change your shake every couple years and what the benefits of that are. And that I think kind of was really the first seedings of like, all right, health needs to become part of this conversation. And at that time, it was very minimal, but I think it had more to do with like how we stand behind the bar and those things, you know, and how we shake and, you know, going from cheap, shitty ice, the hotel ice to the ice that we use now is it's 100% now you're shaking weights essentially every yeah. night you're behind the bar. We should have owned shake weight as a thing.
Yeah, you know,
Our industry would be all retired by now if we could have done that. But yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of really the seedings. And then, you know, you need the groups of people like the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation and BCB and these other
Portland Cocktail Week, and all of them yeah. are now like, promoting. I don't think there's a single bar show or that I've been to within the recent years that doesn't have at least a component of wellness. You know, like a yoga in the morning or a bike ride in the evening or even a fun run or something to keep people moving and not necessarily drinking.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that you've just got a group of bartenders who we are now in our mid to late 30s, early 40s. And for the most part, we are breaking down. And it was really kind of one of those things where we said, all right, if we're going to continue to do this, how do we make the changes the right way?
And both proactive and preventive, yeah. right?
And you have a younger generation who are looking at, who are very into yoga and very into, I kind of would say, expressing themselves and their feelings. And I think that's really helped. I think that's also helped us like have the conversation. Cause I will honestly say, I think a lot of the time, some of us who are, like I said, in our late 30s, early 40s now, probably dealt with it ourselves. And so you was like, if you need to get in shape, you went to the gym
and got
in shape. It was less of a like, hey, let's as bartenders, let's all go like, do this yoga class on Sunday.
Right. Well, let's pool our resources. Let's do it together. It creates some accountability, et cetera. Right. But those things are, you know, come and go as trends, and hopefully wellness won't be one that goes away. And I think that we're on the cusp of more wellness advocacy right now because lots of more low ABV cocktails are coming into play. And now you're actually working for a brand that's no ABV.
Yeah. Yeah. I made the shift to non-alcoholic mixers. It's been really fun. But it's also, you know, I think the, you know, again, when we kind of talk about our industry, we always talk about the trends and the evolution and where we see things going. And, you know, I kind of always like to equate premium mixers to kind of really that, you know, when you look at cocktails, we started with the classics. Then we talked about craft spirits and then seasonality and then using fresh ingredients and then ice and glassware. And I feel like all that stuff, just this is the next kind of part of that math equation that we need to kind of start thinking about is, all right, if we're going to do all this fancy stuff, why are you going to top it with something out of the gun that has a lot of sugar and a lot of like
exactly.
calories? And reality is that it's not a better product for you as a person, but also for your customers and your guests. And, you know, while I'm not necessarily trying to champion the low ABV world, I think this helps in terms of like providing a product out there that allows people who want to go down the low ABV and no ABV world just a better product than some of the ones that are out there. And, you know, I'm not going to say which ones are bad for you. That's for you to figure out. But
at least you can stand behind what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
London Essence is all natural.
Yeah, we're all natural ingredients. We're we're trying to make things that are very low in sugar, very low in calories. And again, we're not trying to do that to be super, super health focused and kind of pushing that agenda. We really just want to make a better product. Because in the end of the day, like, you know, to me, and, you know, you and I have had these conversations as well, Souther, about just the experience. You know, I find that we're in the experience business more than we are in, like, the drinks business.
For sure.
What we do is to provide experiences every day to the people who come into our establishments or come to our events or come to things like this. And, you know, if you can just give people a better experience, I tend to find that they just enjoy themselves and, they leave happy. They have a better day.
They have a better day tomorrow.
Yeah, and then they come back. And then I feel like the better experience you give, you retain your customers, you know, at your bars. You retain brand loyalty for people who like certain products. So, yeah, I think for me, this is just an extension of the experience business. And, you know, I kind of see that that's what's happening now with the low ABV, zero ABV trends that are happening.
Yeah, so it's coming out of nowhere. You know, Philip Duff said at a lecture I saw him do in Kiev, of all places, at Barometer, he said on stage, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And what he was talking about was low ABV. And he said, not 15 years ago, people would say, give me your biggest, tallest glass of booze, but make it taste not like booze.
Right.
And now they're saying, I want something that has no booze in it, but that does taste like booze.
Right. Yeah, we are a funny group of people as humans, right?
Which is, you know, brilliant to even like see that from a distance and recognize it. Like,
I'm still trying to wrap my head around it now. I'm like, whoa.
There are whiskeys out there. There are non-alcoholic whiskeys out there that taste like whiskey.
Right.
When, again, 15 years ago, people would say, give me whiskey, but I don't want it to taste like whiskey.
Well, now you're seeing, I mean, you know.
Or whatever.
You go to these bar shows now. I mean, BCB, I think, had 3 non-alcoholic distilled brands. They had us, they had Seedlip, and then they had another one, starts with an S. Not Seedlip, that did non-alcoholic distilled spirits.
Yeah, there's Ritual out of Chicago, I think. There's like several.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, it is, I think, in its infancy. You know, so you're going through that kind of, you know, we were talking about before off air about being first to market. There's the good things about it, the bad things about it. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're seeing with the non-alcoholic distilled stuff that there is room for growth and maybe development. Some good stuff out there. There's some stuff out there that, I'm not going to call anybody out. There's some stuff out there that I'm not particularly like.
I haven't tried enough of them to have an opinion, to be honest. I still, as Greg just said, it's still a difficult thing for me to wrap my mind around.
Same. I mean, have you been to the, there's a bar not too far from here in Greenpoint that is.
Getaway.
Yeah, the Getaway. Non-alcoholic
bar. Non-alcoholic bar, yeah.
You know, I think you and I, and Greg probably here, like, I think we're.
My mind just says that's a room with stools in it.
and like, you know, not for nothing, I've been to some of these places and it's, you know, I in my head and before I went in there, and I'll be honest, like I had some biases. I thought of them as almost like coffee shops.
Sure.
You know, I was like, all right, you know, you go to a coffee shop because they have coffee and the baristas back there make some cocktails with their, you know, drinks with their coffee or non-alcoholic drinks. And you're like, all right, you know, I'll sit on my computer and, you know, it's kind of like a communal space situation. But yeah, you go to these bars that have non-alcoholic, and they're a bar. They look like a bar, they feel like a bar, and they're just serving non-alcoholic drinks. And I don't know if that's the future by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I don't think it's the future, but I think it's. I honestly feel like I tried not to get too preachy on this show, but I feel like it is something that we kind of have as we've made. Drinking culture is such a big thing as we've kind of pushed, you know, the golden age of cocktails and the cocktail revolution out there into like the wider stratosphere to the point where, you know, people take it seriously as a profession. If you're a bartender now, like I think we kind of have a duty to create that space. Like we've made drinking so cool that we have to like, because, you know, different people react differently to alcohol. We have to create a space where not drinking is cool.
No, and I 100% agree. And I do seminars with London Essence, with USPG chapters, where I talk about the importance of slow and no and low ABV as a functionality within your bar. You know, not from a health perspective because I'm not a health professional, but really from like, why is it good for your bar to think about these things? Why is it good for you to kind of like invest the time and resources into putting that space, as you said, on a menu? And also understanding that some of our actions in the past probably predicated not only bad drinking cultures in certain establishments, but also like short-sightedness in the sense that, like, you know, from a financial perspective, probably not the best thing to do that every time a customer walks in the door, start them off with a shot. If you really think about like how people drink, and there's all types of metrics and health stuff studies done on this, you know, you're loading them up with alcohol in the beginning, they're probably not going to be in your establishment very long spending money versus somebody who's having a enjoyable sessionable cocktail, whether it's a low ABV option, a no ABV option, or even just a well-crafted drink that's just, you know, on alcohol is like lower in volume than like your traditional Manhattans, you're going to have retention of that customer in your space a longer time, which hopefully means more money spent, which hopefully as you as the bartender means more tip percentage for you. And I think
sure, and you ingratiate yourself into them and have them, show them a good time, so they're going to come back and do it again. I think of drinks and drink. I was a chef for 12 years, and so that lingers in my life a lot. So I think of food and drink and how they relate to one another all the time. And for me, if I'm going to have a session, right? If I'm going somewhere and I know I'm going to be there for a while, then I'm going to have, you know, an hors d'oeuvre and then an appetizer and then maybe a salad and then a first course and then maybe a second course and possibly dessert, right? Well, that's the same. If I'm going to arrive and I know that I'm going to an event that starts at noon and doesn't end until midnight, my first drink is not going to be that Manhattan or that old fashioned.
Right. Yeah.
My first drink is going to be, how about a bitters and soda? That's my hors d'oeuvre.
You're not starting out with the steak right away?
Then I might
and
have.
Followed up with a steak.
Then I might have an Americano. Steak. Then I might have, you know, a beer in there somewhere to just pump the brakes. Then I might have, you know, a daiquiri. Then we climb the ladder. Right. And then hopefully by the end of the event, I'm still lucid, but I've had a good time. And you know, just as I would at a meal. And I think that it's unfortunate, but true, we don't necessarily think of that in America anyway. You know, like I feel like happy hour in America is as much as I can drink for half price, so twice as much for half the price.
Right. Because we like value.
As fast as I can. Yeah. Well, whereas like in Italy, it's aperitif hour, and it's like 3 hours long, and it's low ABV, something always kind of bubbly. There's always a snack involved to keep you in check. Mm. And then you go to dinner afterwards. Like here, I feel like you go to that happy hour, you crank it up to 11, you go home and cook up a box of, you know, the blue box of macaroni and cheese, and you pass out, and you go to work in the morning and start over, right?
That was one of the things I learned also, you know, from my time overseas, was that happy hour in Europe tends to not be no more than a couple hours. Whereas in this country, like you can do, I mean, there's happy hours that are all day, right?
Yeah, yeah. Sunday, all day happy hour.
There's happy hours that start at from like noon till 5, then they do another happy hour at like 8 p.m. So you really only have 3 hours that you're doing like full price
normal service. Yeah.
So I think, you know, in this culture, and we're not the only ones because there's obviously other cultures that do this as well, but like we definitely are all about like, you know, hey, can I get it cheap? Can I get a lot for it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're all about value. I want as much as I can for as low price as possible to then kind of be intoxicated for the rest of the day.
My best friend, I'm going to call you out, Todd. My best friend, Todd, he's a professor at NYU, local college here in New York. But when he was a grad student, I remember very clearly we lived near Barcade. Barcade has it's a beer bar that serves all kinds of craft beers, and they have an arcade in there of vintage arcade games. And they have a huge chalkboard where they change the beers, and they write, not only do they write the beer, they write its ABV, they write the size of the glass and the price. And Todd is a whiz with math. And he would literally stand there and scan the board and be like, that's the best beer for the buck because I'm on a budget because I'm in grad school. And he would order beer based on cost, size, and ABV, knowing that he could get as quote-unquote drunk or buzzed as he wanted to get with the cheapest dollar. That's how I think the American thinks.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. And, you know, the cool thing about what I have seen with this...
Thanks, Todd.
there's so many Todds out there we want to...
Yeah.
But the cool thing that I see with like this, and again, I don't want to say it's a trend. Hopefully it's a thing that we just become more cognizant of.
Yeah, just incorporated into the system.
Is, you know, I think in you guys are bartenders and you both probably have seen this evolution as well, is that, you know, for the most of the bars that I've been to, and even I'm guilty in the bars that I worked in the past, I kind of looked at non-alcoholic and low ABV cocktails as almost like a not only a secondary thought, but like so far down my priority list of things I needed to think about that I never really developed them properly. So then when they were on when they were on a menu, it was a massive afterthought. Mm-hmm. They weren't very good.
Yep.
They were just juices thrown together really to kind of appease what I assumed was the small mass of people who I'd have to make this drink for. And really, and you just were touching upon that, you know, people, there's so many different reasons why people don't drink these days or looking to have much more of a sessionable night. Yeah. That I would love to see really with bartenders is take this as an opportunity to be super innovative and kind of look at the low ABV world and the no ABV world as kind of the same thing that we did with like our embracing of the classic cocktails and the, you know, the seasonality. And we got super creative and all of a sudden you had drinks that were like 10 touch point cocktails. And obviously I think we've gotten past that element, but I'd like to see the bar world kind of embrace this is an opportunity to kind of create some really cool stuff and look at the low ABV, no ABV world as an opportunity versus a burden or something you have to react to. And hopefully if we do that, I think you just, you know, we touched on it earlier. I think we just give better experiences to everybody who comes through our door.
Yeah. And we can have fun doing it too, right? Like we've had fun for decades now, you and I anyway, making drinks and, you know, mixing alcoholic things together to make something that's, you know, a sum of a bunch of different things that I like mixed together to make a new thing that I like.
Yeah.
Right. We can do the same thing with non-alcoholic. And I think that's,
well, I think, you know, we're a culture of bartenders who like innovation. Right. And let's also be honest. Like, I don't think there's going to be a new, like spirit that comes around anytime soon that's just going to like blow our minds and change the way we perceive things. But if it does, great. That's awesome, right? It gives us
Baiju. It's coming.
If that's it, perfect. You know, there's so many cool things out there, especially if you go to like South America and you guys stumble upon some of the local distilled stuff they make. It's great. But again, like I think as an innovative culture of bartenders, especially in this country and Europe, you know, I think it's just something that gives us more ammunition in our arsenal to kind of like play around with.
Well, and like I lived with vegans for a while, and I still to this day love cooking vegan. I'm not vegan. I eat everything. But there's something fun about like cooking with one hand tied behind your back almost, and it makes you appreciate the ingredients there more. Like, you know, if I'm
Did you making, actually try to cook with one hand behind your back? Because I would pay to see that.
Yeah. only the time that I burned my hand really horribly and it was out of commission for a while. Not singed, burned. But yeah, it's like, you know, and if you're making a dish with like, if you're making like a big like Italian thing and you're throwing like all this sausage in there and like, you know, tons of garlic and all this other crap, like if you're cooking with that and the recipe calls for mushroom, at a certain point with all that other stuff in there, a mushroom is a mushroom is a mushroom. But if you cut everything else out of there out, you have to really focus on the individual mushrooms that you're using. It's kind of the same with,
yeah.
It's you're like you were saying, it's another avenue for innovation.
Yeah.
Just don't try and mix drinks with one hand behind your back.
Yeah.
Could get sloppy.
Well, yeah, but it could be fun, right? I think we wanted to talk about this a little bit too, right? Bartending, well, you said to me off the air, you said, let's bring fun back into bartending. What do you mean by that? Do you not have fun anymore? Do you think it's not the same fun?
It's not the, you know, it's not the same. And I don't want to take this into a political conversation because I know a lot of people are going to be like, well, you know, there's these things that are popping up and it kind of like has created this political social warrior thing in our bar community.
Sure. Well, in all communities, but yeah. I feel like we're so close knit, it really pops up a lot. Of course,
we're all friends with each other on social media, which is good and bad at the same time, right?
Yep, agreed.
But I think the thing that kind of that I see happening now, and I could be wrong. I travel a lot to a lot of different cities, and I go to a lot of bars, so I get to see from a U.S. perspective the example I'm making. But I really feel like we've kind of like. We've gotten really serious about our occupation, which I think is fantastic. And I think we really invested a lot of time and effort into trying to make others feel like they see us as equals in the occupation we have. But I just kind of feel like a lot of bars nowadays are missing that one element of like, and I don't want to say personality, but just the idea of fun behind a bar. You know, I think there's several of us who came from bartending at the young age of 18 and up who kind of had to work in nightclubs and sports bars and everything, and you kind of like take that amalgamation of experiences and you are who you are when you are behind the bar. I think we just don't have right now a lot of generation of bartenders who I feel like have spent a lot of time working in other establishments, so that when you do go into their establishment, you're only getting, I think, a little bit of like their what they could be, right? So when you go into a bar, and I feel like everything is kind of trying to be a cocktail bar these days. And I think a lot of cities are dependent on what you can do with the build out and the cost. And I understand all those things as somebody who owns a bar. You know, you can't make every spot feel like Applebee's, right? You can't, not that that's a fun bar, but you know, you can't do that in every establishment because you've got costs and whatnot. But I just feel like there's an element of fun where you would go to see a certain person at a bar and you knew you were just going to have a good time. There was a long period of time where we said, I don't even know if I'll have a good drink at that place, but I go there.
Yeah.
But now
I remember those bars.
Yeah, right.
I still go to a few of them.
And now we say like, I can tell you where to go to get a great cocktail, and that's great. Like that's what we want in this industry. And that's awesome. But I kind of find in a lot of cities and New York has a lot of these establishments where it's like, you can go there, get a great cocktail, but I don't know if it's necessary. Are you going to have a great time?
Right.
That I can't really vouch for. And I think that's where, you know, I think as we evolve in this world, and especially like with all the bar convents and you know, Tales of the Cocktail and all these cocktail weeks, you know, I look at all these seminars that are coming out there, and not one of them really kind of takes the idea of like, how do we bring more fun into our behind the bar personalities, you know, and creating spaces in bars where it's, yeah, you can still get a great cocktail, you can still get a great bite to eat, but then you're also going to have a great time. And I think that the bars that we go to, I think that if you add them all up, the ones that we would say are both fun, great drinks, great experience is a smaller slice of the pie than what
which,
it probably used to
which
be.
We're already talking about a small slice of the pie, right? We all know that we're like the 1% of bars, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about even smaller than that. What are you doing at Sweetwater to sort of generate that kind of culture among your team?
So, you know, one of the things that we try to identify, you know, Tim and I specifically, is we kind of lean heavily more on trying to find people who are just personable, right? Like, I know that's an easy thing to say because not everybody can find personalities when they walk through the door when they're hiring, but we really try to find people who are personable. And then we say, look, we want you to shine as an individual. We'll give you the tools and skill set to bartend, you know, even if we have to train you and break you down to bartend. But like, we want you to take that personality that you have and put that on display and really kind of say, you know, let's do things that we try to make sure that we have activities in our bar. And again, not every bar wants or should have activities, but we try to implement with some games. We obviously have entertainment, and Tim and I also are very big into music. We feel that music is a real big way to kind of establish an atmosphere. So we try to shy away from like depressing music.
Yeah.
We shy away from like the Smiths and, you know, things that were big in like the 80s and 90s that were like kind of like emo and a lot of goth type. We very much into like funk, old school hip hop.
Sure. You know, beat tempo. It's going to get people's head bobbing.
You know, nothing. We try to stay away from a lot of top 40 stuff because, again, we're not trying to be poppy. We're not trying to. We stay away from like heavy like R&B. We want to create an atmosphere where, like, people, if they're in their late 50s to their early 20s, a song comes on that they recognize and they have a good time. And like I said, with us, our staff specifically, we try to make sure that the bartenders and servers are personable. And if they're not, we're more likely to have a sit down with them than we would if they just are making a drink wrong all the time.
Right.
You know, we'll correct them on their technique. We'll make sure that they understand, hey, you got to make this drink right. But like, if they're just not personable, then it's usually because either something we're doing behind the bar as owners, or the environment is just not conducive for their personality so that they don't feel they can let it shine. And I feel like that's kind of what I'm seeing in a lot of places. I see a lot of bartenders who have really good technique and really good skill working in bars, but maybe the bar is a little too confined in terms of letting their personality be out and about.
Have you ever had an opportunity to go to Nickel City, Travis Tover's place?
That is an amazing bar. I think
I haven't been there. I haven't been there, but I know that the deal is pretty much they try and make sure that every single person gets either a handshake or a high five before they leave, right?
Yep.
Like when you come in the door, you might get a handshake, but by the time you leave, you might get a high five. And, like, and they just want to touch and every single person's experience there,
right?
Which is amazing. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think there's a, and again, like,
it's not like a corporate dictum. It's just sort of like, this is our style. Yeah,
I think I would say to most bartenders out there who are thinking about opening and owning a bar, don't go and copy Nickel City, you know, but go see it.
Yeah.
Go see what he's doing and go see. And there's other places. I mean, I think, again, we have those places. We have some spots here in New York. We have places in Miami, Austin, San Francisco. I mean, Trick Dog in San Francisco, you know, when you walked in that spot, those guys are very personable. You know, Josh and his team, the guys at ABV have done the same thing. But again, you know, you try to look at the overall bar community. And again, we're still talking about a small amount of those bars. And I just hope that we try to, when we're doing these bar designs and these bar menus and all this education that we talk about, and you see these trends that are happening, I'd like for us to maybe start talking more about like, how do we make this fun as well? You know?
Yeah. Well, that's a good place to end. It's really been a great conversation having you in the studio with us today. If anybody wanted to reach out to you and talk about London Essence or Sweetwater Social or your travels around the world, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I mean, you can always just call me because I like being called and text. So
yeah, you're definitely old school.
You know, my Instagram is you know, I have my personal one, which is JJNLLC15, and then I also have London Essence at JustinUSA. Follow me on Facebook at Justin Noel. And yeah, again, you know, my phone number is 770-833-7838.
Bold.
I did that. Yeah.
Bold.
I guarantee you I'm not going to get blown up, but please text me. I always like answering texts, phone calls. You know, you put it out there. I travel so much that, like, really, I spend a lot of time with my phone. So if I get phone calls or texts, I'm usually there to answer it. And yeah, man, I like taking photos of my travels, and appreciate you guys having me in here to talk about this.
Man, really great to have you. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention I'm feeling a little sick today. I woke up with the beginnings of a cold, and sitting here throughout the whole show sipping on some London Essence ginger ale has been quite good for me, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I brought in some bitters because I figured, you know, when you texted me saying you were sick, I was like, you know what, let's bring in some not my, it's my version of a bitters and club soda with Lauren Moat's Bitter Sling
from Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got some great stuff. Well, I appreciate you bringing that stuff in as well. Well, that's it for this week's Speakeasy. Tune in next week for more, and we'll see you then. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Bye.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some in the end.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.